Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, also broadcasting live 4 days a week on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Let's not forget also our New Zealand affiliates, which I barely mention, which is silly, because about 30% of my audience are New Zealanders, about 60% American, and the rest is kind of split. So it's a very global kind of confab that goes on here. About, I remember I checked the analytics one day, and there are about 212 different countries that were identified by its tracker that's visiting the website. So if we have anything to learn, it's that the globalists have been relatively successful in setting up a global network to enslave everybody. What's been very interesting is that those exact same mechanisms by which we get enslaved can be used against them to free us. That's what alternative talk radio is really all about. That's what YouTube has become about for a lot of people. We now have a voice. We now have the technology. For the first time in history, we're capable of exposing things that, for all intents and purposes, were hoped to have never be exposed throughout the entirety of history. But exposed, they do get anyway. One of these very important issues, or at least, I'm not 100% sure exactly how important it is in the grand scheme of things, but it's extremely interesting and a very poignant example of exactly how the truth gets kept for people from a very long period of time. My very special guest is Jarrah White, calling in to us from Australia. Jarrah, welcome to the program.
It's good to be back here. It's been quite a while since I was last on the show. If I recall correctly, the last show that I did with you guys was in 2011, and well, a lot has happened since then.
And also, ladies and gentlemen, Jarrah's website, moonfaker.com, and his YouTube channel, youtube.com/whitejarrah, which is also a type of latte. Now, Jarrah, I would like you to give us a wee bit of an update, because anything in the last 4 years that's come up new about a subject that happened, what, 50, 60, 70 years ago now? Is bound to be interesting.
It was about 46 years ago, I believe. I can't remember the exact, it was basically more than 40. So what's happened in recent times has been quite a few things happening. The Russians, they landed their own unmanned mission on the moon and found the rock samples, or the soil, I should say, is different from the, chemically different from what they were supposedly brought back on the Apollo. I recently looked at the frame rates of the Apollo 11 and found that the frame rate is much higher than what NASA claimed, meaning it had to have been shot with a camera that wasn't in their possession when they were supposedly on the moon on Apollo 11. And NASA themselves, they kind of shot themselves in the foot a bit with their Orion spacecraft. The Orion was recently flown into the Van Allen belt, basically with some Geiger counters aboard to measure the radiation. And this spacecraft was rated at about 20 grams per square centimeter, which is about three times the maximum shielding on the Apollo spacecraft. And even with that additional shielding, the dose rates that they detected were much higher than what they were predicting for that kind of shielding. It was slightly less than what they were predicting for a shield of 10 grams per square centimeter. And so the point is that the more shielding that you have, the less radiation would be. The dose rates that they observed was as high as about six reds per hour. All right. And so just to put that into perspective, that's about 100 millireds per hour. Per minute. All right. And so back in the day when they had the Concorde, when they would fly over the poles, they had regulations to minimize the radiation hazard that they, because you understand the poles, there has not much magnetic field there, so the radiation is more intense up there, more felt more strongly, I should say. And so if the doses aboard the Concorde exceeded 100 millirads per hour, the pilots were told to essentially avoid the polar route altogether. Right, now try 100 millirads per minute. Okay, and now the resulting dose was much higher than what NASA claims that they absorbed on the Apollo missions. On the Apollo missions, the skin dose alone was always about something on the lines of 0.2 rads, Okay, and so this is the cumulative dose of what they got under 20 grams per square centimeter was like 2 rads. Okay, so if anything, since it's so much more heavily shielded, we should have expected the dose rate to be non-existent. Instead, it's much higher than what was detected on Apollo. And you know, there's a publication from the 1960s, Astronautical Engineering and Science. On page 225, there's a graph plotting the shielding against the dose rates. The dose rates that were reported on Orion are quite similar to what was reported in the book. They were expecting doses on the order of eight rads per hour for a 20 gram per square centimeter shielding, right? For a 7 gram per square centimeter shielding, which is what NASA claims they had on Apollo, the dose would have been much, much higher, much more than about more than 20 rads per hour. Okay, and to put that into perspective, and Alan Hee went on to the record to say that a human being exposed for 2 days to even 10 rentgens, which is about 9.216 rads, basically said a person exposed to that kind of radiation for as little as 2 days would have an even chance of survival. And now it's been absorbed, you know, in an hour. So obviously it's a hazard to spaceflight.
Now, this means essentially that spaceflight was simply too dangerous to pull it off. Is it even possible to pull it off now?
Well, it depends on what you mean by spaceflight. If you're only flying below the Van Allen radiation belt, which is where the International Space Station orbits, then you should be fine, because you see the way it works.
I'm specifically asking, can we get away from Earth and go to other planetary bodies or the Moon?
Not with the technology that they had back in the 60s, although there has been some developments that could possibly overcome this obstacle. The SpaceX organization, the private company that Elon Musk assembled, he's proposing a rocket called the Falcon 20, right, which is this enormous rocket which can lift up to 200 tons to Earth orbit. With two additional first stages of side boosters, it could lift an additional 400 tons, so that's a total of 600 tons to Earth orbit. Now, the payload of rocket's payload to the Moon is about a third of its payload to Earth orbit, right? So if you had the Dragon spacecraft, which weighs about 6 tons, right, a shield with 2 meters of water basically surrounding this circular capsule, okay, that would be another 109 tons, okay? So that's total craft would be about 115 tons. Okay, with the you could send that to the Moon with a single launch of the Falcon 20. Right? That could get you through you'd have to transfer to the shelter before you actually go into the belt. But the point is, in that shelter, you would be protected from the radiation. Now, there's been research by a woman by the name of Erica Harnett, and she proposes to minimize the radiation hazard on the flight to the Moon, she proposes that we would launch during the full moon, because during that time, you see, the Earth has this magnetic field and which deflects or traps the radiation. That's why we have a magnetic field, why we have a Van Allen radiation belt in the first place. But on the far side of the Earth, the side that's facing away from the sun, the solar wind actually pushes the magnetic field backwards, far beyond the orbit of the Moon. So it creates this tail, essentially, this magnetic field tail. Okay, and during the Moon spends about 20% of its orbit within this tail. During that time, it's completely shielded by solar flares and most of the galactic cosmic rays. So the idea is that you would coast down this tail, catch up with the Moon, do all the things that you've got to do on the Moon's surface, and just before it leaves this tail, you would launch back off the Moon and head back down the tail back to Earth. Okay, so I believe that we could use SpaceX technology once the Falcon 20 Heavy becomes feasible, right? Once they build this thing, I believe we could solve the radiation hazard and get people to the Moon for real. This would be in about next 10, 20 years from now, so we can only hope.
So we can't even get to another planetoid body but for 20 years from now, let alone having gone to the Moon?
We can't get it without this technology, and we have to essentially wait until this rocket is built and has been tested and everything else. They've made some improvements on the Dragon spacecraft. They unveiled their Dragon V2, which is designed to actually make propulsive landings onto any solid body in the solar system, even the Earth. The idea is that instead of using a parachute, you would use the escape rockets to basically they would fire and guide you back down to the surface with the accuracy of a helicopter. Okay, that's the ultimate goal of SpaceX. But of course, this technology wasn't available back during the Apollo missions. The Saturn V couldn't have lifted the additional shelter module that would have been required to survive the radiation. And furthermore, the Apollo astronauts did not go during the full moon. They went during a time, allegedly, they went during a time that the moon was outside the magnetic field of the Earth.
So,
in fact, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking this, at the time that they're promoting this whole thing, we need to go to the moon, we've got to get there before the Russians, there's a whole mess of crash and burn sort of test experiments with these spacecraft that you just wouldn't believe how much destruction they went through just in order to try and get a landing module. And I wonder, did they just kind of give up at some point and go, you know, bro, it's actually it's just too hard. We just can't do it. Why don't we just bullshit people and tell them we did it anyway? That's the American thing to do, isn't it? Well, of course it is. Why wouldn't we?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Bill Kaysing, he actually had a whole section about that in his book. It was in the in 1961 when they assembled this organization, NASA and the Defense Intelligence Agency. They assembled this organization called the Apollo Simulation Project, which essentially got together and basically conjured up all these proposals on how they could go about simulating flights to the moon and then purport them to be the real thing. One of the big issues they were having at the time, apart from the radiation, obviously, was that they had trouble with the F1 engines that they were going to use on the Saturn V rocket. These things, they kept blowing up on the test beds. They kept blowing up all over the place. They had combustion instability problems.
So they were sitting around just going, "What kind of engine should we have them? Oh, just give them the F1s, bro. It'll be sweet ass."
Yeah, the idea was the F1 is because their thing, ideally that had about 1.5 million tons, million pounds of thrust or something like that, and so it was ideal for heavy lift rockets. But the problem was that it was very prone to combustion instability. They did all kinds. They even had this project called Project First, which was tried to overcome the combustion instability problems. And this thing went on throughout Kaysing's career, and about a year after he left Rocketdyne. But even after all this testing and improvements they tried to do and stuff, the ultimate conclusion was that there was no guarantee that they could that the problem was solved. Right, so essentially, they von Braun had to install these engines on the Saturn V on the hope that it would work. Essentially, that was the situation. So, anyways, one of the proposals that they had in this Apollo simulation project was to, instead of using the combustion instability prone F1s, they would use the H1 engines that they would use on the smaller Saturn, the Saturn B1, and then they would basically launched this Saturn. It didn't have these much less powerful engines. They wouldn't have been able to send the craft to the moon. So they would just either launch the capsule and jettison into the South Atlantic with all the astronauts still safely on the Earth somewhere. Okay, sort of like Peter Hine actually borrowed the proposals that were written up in Kaysing's book. He actually used them in Capricorn 1. But the idea is that they would launch either the capsule unmanned, right, and just keep the astronauts on Earth, or they would only send them into Earth orbit where they would remain for the duration of the flight. If they were in Earth orbit during this time, they would, or even if they were on the ground, either way, they would actually relay their voices to an unmanned craft that was on its way to the moon, okay, which would basically simulate the positions of the astronauts. So if anyone wanted to tune in, they think, oh, it's coming from the moon. No, it must be true. In fact, the Russians, they actually did something similar on their Zond 5 mission. The Zond program was essentially a stripped-down Russian Soyuz capsule, okay? And so the idea was that we would stack this thing on top of the Proton rocket, send it straight to the moon, around the moon, and back to the Earth again, okay? They had the Zond 5 mission, and when it was circled around the moon, people at in the United States and also in Europe, in England, at Jodrell Bank, for example, they detected the voices of Pavel Popovich and Vitaly Savastinov coming from the spacecraft. And at the time, everyone thought the spacecraft was manned, but it turned out that the cosmonauts were actually in a bunker somewhere in Moscow. They were just relaying their voices to the capsule, which then transmitted them back to Earth. And that was all officially revealed. right? So people, they say, oh, well, how they, you got people like Parks and Honeysuckle Creek and Goldstone and ham operators and whatever tracking the missions to the moon and stuff. Well, how do they get all this information back? Well, it doesn't prove anything when you take into consideration that these voices can be simulated by simply just sending an unmanned craft there and transmitting the voices back to the Earth. You know, so that doesn't really prove nothing. And so others have cited, you know, the laser reflectors and stuff. Well, first of all, the Russians did that without sending a man to the moon. And you, even before the laser reflectors, that you'd bounce lasers off the moon unmet off the moon's bare surface, essentially. They did that at MIT and the Crimean Astrophysical Observatory. That's all reported in the New York Times and National Geographic and so forth. Now, what they did to simulate the videos of them on the moon, allegedly, was that they would suspend the astronauts on wires, right, and have them walk around the place doing their activities, and they would play that video back in slow motion, about at 67% the full speed. Now, here's the thing. NASA, for the Apollo 11, they said that the video camera that recorded the moonwalk that we all saw was a 10 frame per second camera. What that means is that every frame, the camera would record 10 pictures. Okay, what they use in the United States, they use a NTSC, which is 30 frames per second. Here in Australia, we use PAL, which is 25 frames per second. The point is, the conventional frame rates are much higher than the slow scan TV camera that they allegedly had on Apollo 11. All right, so to broadcast this to the world, they had to convert it to NTSC. And they did this by crudely basically pointing a TV camera at the screen, projecting this 10 frame per second feed, basically so the camera would record each frame in the 10 frame per second playback three times. Again, they would broadcast that to the world. Obviously, the picture quality was reduced significantly as a result of that. But the important thing to note is that if you had a 10 frame per second video and then converted it to 30 frames per second by the method I just described, okay, the camera that would point at the screen would record the same frame three times. So if you were to basically go through the playback of that, you would see, okay, here's the picture. It would remain the same next two frames, then it would change. It would remain the same for the next two frames, then it would change again. Basically, it's recorded the same picture three times. So obviously, each three frames would be the same. There might be differences in picture distortion and the like, but otherwise, the graphics would be the same. The astronaut on the screen would have the same position for three frames. So I took the liberty of extracting 90 sequential frames from the telecast, from the Apollo 11 telecast, and I viewed them frame by frame. And instead of the picture updating once every three frames, the picture updated four out of every five frames. The remainder was an overlay of the frames immediately before and after. Right, so that indicates that the playback speed was not 10 frames per second, but 24 frames per second. Therefore, it had to have been shot with a camera that reportedly was not in their possession when they were supposedly on the moon on Apollo 11. Because they only said they only had a 10 frame per second video camera. They didn't have a 24 frame per second video camera. They just had the 10 frame per second video camera. They had a film camera, which we recorded at 1 frame per second. Of course, that was film, so it has to be developed first. They wouldn't have been able to broadcast it in the first place. But the point is, they didn't have a 24 frame per second video camera on the moon. How the hell did they get 24 frames out of this video?
By slowing it down to one-third the speed?
Well, the idea is that it was slowed down to two-thirds normal speed. So if it's 24 frames per second, it would have to be about 36 frames per second originally and stuff. But the point is that they didn't have this camera, so that alone proves that the official NASA story is false. Okay, because they didn't have this camera. They specifically said they only had 10 frames per second, and yet here we got this video that's 24 frames per second. If your listeners want to see more about this, I recommend you go onto YouTube and do a search on Moonfaker false frame rates, and you'll see the analysis there. I also recommend you go onto YouTube and do a search on Moonfaker Chinese road trip. As I mentioned before, the Chinese, they landed their own unmanned mission on the moon, the Chang'e 3. This mission deployed a rover, which basically had a active particle backscatter spectrometer aboard. What this thing does is it takes a rock sample and showers it with a spray of X-ray photons. Okay, the X-rays interact with the atoms that the rock is composed of, excites those atoms, and in turn the atoms then lose energy in the form of X-rays, which is then shot essentially back at the instrument, which is then measured, and so they They released the graph, they released the X-ray spectral data on their website. If you imagine what it looks like, is essentially you've got the counts per second plotted on the vertical axis, and you've got the energy level plotted on the horizontal, and so you've got this squiggly line across the screen. Now, each atom will release a different amount of energy, and so the amount of energy can help you narrow down what type of element it must be. Okay, this must be iron, this must be silicon, this must be calcium, etc., etc. Okay, and so the counts plotted on the vertical will tell you how much of the material there is. Okay, so they didn't mention what the chemical composition is, so I had to get that data myself. So I measured the heights of each peak, converted from log to linear. Basically, there was no oxygen listed in there because that was outside the spectral range. So I had to add the oxygen in there based on do the calculations for that. And once I got the chemical composition, I decided to pitch them against the Apollo samples and see how they compared. And the numbers really have to be seen to be believed. For magnesium, for example, the Apollo samples are about 10% by weight magnesium oxide, whereas the Chang'e 3 is about 0.2%. Okay, for aluminium, they're around 15%, and Chang'e 3 is about 0.75. Silica, which is the most prominent chem element in the elemental compound in the soil, is about 45% in the Apollo soils, but in Chang'e 3 it's only 4%. And for calcium is about 42% in the Chang'e 3, but only about 10% in the Apollo soils. Titanium is in similar abundances in the Chang'e 3 soil. It's about 40%, whereas in Apollo's it's about 1-10%. And it just goes on and on. The chemical composition is completely unlike anything that we even know about. Okay. It's with the exception of the high titanium peak, the spectra itself looks like limestone, which shouldn't exist on the moon because, the moon has no atmosphere, it has no weathering processes, so you can't get limestone on the moon. So it would indicate that the Chang'e 3 has detected essentially the moon to be made of this new rock type, which is completely unlike anything that we've ever would even dream of, essentially. And this, of course, can be correlated with what happened on the Russian missions and on the European Space Agency Smart 1 mission, when the Smart 1 crashed into the moon and sent up all this material for the scientists to analyze with the ground-based telescopes. It was reported that the Smart 1 had uncovered minerals different to the rocks gathered on the surface during moonwalks. And with the Russian missions, the Russians differed from the Apollo samples in the fact that they contained no ferric iron. You see, what happens is if you have a piece of iron, or either metallic iron or even ferrous iron, which is iron oxide, FeO, right? What happens if you expose it to air and water for a long time? It rusts. It rusts. It becomes Fe2O3. Okay, that's ferric iron. Okay, and if there's no air on the moon, there's no water on the moon except in the polar regions, of course, where it gets much colder. It's below the boiling point of water there, right? There's no air or water on the moon, so how can you get the ferric iron oxide in the Apollo samples, which is what they have? They have copious amounts. The water is about 0.6% by weight, and they got ferric iron as a result of it. The first two Russian missions, Luna 16 and Luna 20, they contained no water, no rust. The Luna 24, which drilled about 2 meters under the surface, it found only 1,000 parts per million of water, which is less than what the Apollo astronauts supposedly collected. And of course, they had to find it by drilling deep underwater. And yet, the Apollo astronauts were able to find 6,000 parts per million of water in surface rocks they collected off the surface, not rocks they drilled underground, but rocks they collected up the surface. And of course, in recent remote detect missions, they found no water at the equatorial regions. Just the only places on the moon where they found comparable amounts of water was in the poles. Up there, the most they found was about 0.3% by weight water. The poles was about 0.6%. So this is only about half what there was found in the surface rocks, and nowhere does it register in the equatorial regions.
So how exactly does this stack up? Where do you think they actually got the samples from? Are some of them, like the Apollo missions, working with fake samples? Like, where would they get them from?
I believe that what they used was a combination of terrestrial mafic igneous rocks and HED meteorites. HED is howardite, eucrine, and eogenite. These are meteorites that were originally believed to have come from, well, now they believe, I should say, they're believed to have come from asteroid 4 Vesta. And so In fact, when they got the Apollo samples back, they were the HED meteorites were considered to be candidates for lunar meteorites, and in fact, there has been a lot of eucrites and stuff that have been originally classed as lunar meteorites, but later were identified as eucrites and vice versa. Like DAG-872 had a oxygen isotope signature, which was comparable to the Apollo samples. It was originally thought to be a lunar sample, was later declared a eucrite. Elephant Maureen 87521 was originally classed as a eucrite, but then was later classed as a lunar meteorite. And of course, then this is a controversial topic. In fact, I'm actually doing a report on this for my course. There's a glassy portions called tektites. See, glass. When a meteorite collides with the Earth and crashes, sends up all this molten glass up into space and it falls back down to Earth, those are called tektites. The molten glass that falls down to Earth is called tektites. And when they got the samples back, there was a huge controversy back and forth about finding tektite glass in the Apollo samples. You know, there was people say, "Oh, we found tektite glass in there." Say, "No, it's not." And there's a huge back and forth amongst the geologists, because like some people reckon tektites were formed by meteorites colliding with the Earth and sending all this molten glass up. Others reckon they came from the moon. One of the reasons is because they find tektite like glass in the Apollo samples.
So what does that mean? Where did they get the samples from?
Oh, okay. Well, one of the likely place where they would have got it would have been from Antarctica, because there's vast amounts of meteorites in Antarctica. Okay, and in fact, von Braun, he actually went to Antarctica a couple of years prior to the moon missions. All right, and why would he need to go to the Antarctica for? A lot of people say, oh, he went there to test equipment there and stuff. Well, what kind of testing could be done in Antarctica that couldn't be done, you know, closer to home in Alaska or in a giant purpose-built freezer? That doesn't make any sense, you know. And so prior to his visit, they had found a few meteorites in Antarctica, and it was later established that Antarctica was this gold mine of meteorites in general, essentially. And so they could have gotten the meteorite, the eucrites, the haldites from Antarctica. There's rocks of similar age up in Quebec, I believe, where you can get basalts and the like there. And there's also, as I said, the tektites. You can get those there, dime a dozen in Australia, essentially. And so, yeah. So the point is that the Apollo samples that they got were a combination of terrestrial mafic igneous rocks, HEDs, and possibly even tektites. Okay, the real clincher, I guess, is the whole fact that the samples that were recovered by the Russians, the samples that were detected by the Chinese and the Soviets, different from the American samples. Okay, and the fact that the American samples contain copious amounts of water and ferric iron oxide, you can't get that without exposing it to the atmosphere and water for a long time. That's just not going to happen.
So, ergo, their samples came from Earth.
Yeah, came from Earth, essentially, yes.
So there was no manned mission that could have actually gotten those rocks anyway, unless it was a manned mission to Earth, where they already were.
Yeah, essentially, yes. Yes, the whole fact of the matter is they couldn't survive the radiation hazard. The rock samples, they don't add up, and now we've got video footage, essentially, that shows that the Apollo 11, at least, that was shot with a camera that wasn't in their possession when they were supposedly on the moon. Another thing that's recently come up is the whole subject about the flag. A lot of people, they discuss whether the flag would still be standing at the landing site. In 2009, NASA released photos from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which allegedly showed the hardware still on the surface. Allegedly, all we see are little smudgy pixels and light doesn't reveal anything. And that's despite the fact that we've got, you know, the GOI-1 circling the Earth, photographing people walking the streets, the cars, and all clearly distinct. There's pictures that you would be astounded by the resolution. And yet NASA can't reveal a clear picture of the hardware. But that's beside the point right now. The point is that more recently they released pictures allegedly showing the flag casting a shadow, And basically, you can see how it changes over time. It gets elongated in the mornings or evenings and stuff. Gets shorter as it gets towards noon and stuff. They release these on their site, but that's impossible. And the reason why is because on the moon and also in Earth orbit, you have micrometeoroids zipping past, and you know, which would zip right through the flag. And in fact, on the Mir station, this was in 1991, the Russians, or rather the Soviets, they erected their own Soviet flag outside the Mir space station up on the mast, okay? And in less than 2 years, right, over a period of 2 years, they kept getting battered and battered by micrometeoroids and, to a lesser extent, the radiation, you know, hitting that you would encounter in Earth. As I said before, the radiation in Earth orbit is not as severe as it would be in the Van Allen belt or on the moon outside the magnetic field. But the point is, the flag kept getting battered and battered by all this this space junk, these meteoroids, this radiation, and of course there's debris from other satellites in Earth orbit. Of course, you have to take the calculations to take the danger of orbital debris out of the equation, because they don't get satellite junk, you know, smashing around on the moon, because there's less missions to the moon than there is in Earth orbit. But the point is that the flag was reduced to shreds within 2 years. Okay, they couldn't just form a spacewalk to retrieve them, because the Soviet Union, remember, it collapsed after they erected this flag. So they erected the Soviet Union flag. Hooray, we hail the Soviet Union flag. Oh, the Soviet Union collapsed. Oh. Well, the flag is outdated. Should we take it down? No, we're coming to do a unscheduled spacewalk just for something as trivial as that. So 2 years go by, when they finally get a chance to retrieve it, the flag is just reduced to two threads, essentially. Okay. Now you do the calculations to take the danger of orbital debris out of the equation, as I said before, and you find that the flags wouldn't have lasted much longer than 10 years. The flags on the moon wouldn't have lasted more than 10 years. And yet NASA claims they have photos from the LRO showing the flags casting a shadow. How the hell did it survive 40-plus years of solar radiation and micrometeoroid bombardment? That just doesn't happen, which indicates that...
I'll just take a stab in the dark here. How did it survive? Photoshop.
Yeah, Photoshop. You read my mind there. That's the whole situation. Any photographs that NASA shows a smudge of pixels that we're supposed to believe is a flag casting a shadow is a photo manipulation, which of course begs the question, why would they need to be photo manipulating post-Apollo photography if the missions were for real?
Why would they need to do anything? I mean, what in the hell does NASA actually do? I mean, really? Everything that they claim that they're doing and everything that they're showing everybody, to my mind and whatever I've looked into, is a fraud. So is NASA specifically just there as some kind of fraudulent, you know, it's kind of like some sort of a space scam, you know, starring Bugs Bunny?
I believe in the beginning, of course, NASA, they started off as sincere. They were legitimately doing things, you know, like sending space probes into, you know, to visit other planets or to visit the moon and visit. They even sent, you know, John Glenn and Alan Shepard, all the Mercury astronauts and some of the Gemini missions. They were for real.
Okay? So what happened? They just started exploring the galaxy and then they just, we've seen enough. Fuck it.
That's the whole issue too, is because when they had the Apollo missions, there were much more elaborate proposals for manned exploration. They had plans for setting up a base on the moon. There was plans for sending manned missions to Mars, a manned flyby around Venus, and the like. You know, but that was irrelevant to the military goal. The military goal was to get to the moon before the Soviets. Okay, we do that with Apollo 11. Now what? Now, there's all these other missions, but that's irrelevant. We completed the military objective. We just wanted to, you know, shout off our mouths, look what we can do. So they needed an excuse to cancel the Apollo program, and that excuse they got with Apollo 13. The near disaster of the Apollo 13, you know, oxygen tank explodes. Oh, my God, the astronauts are in danger. They successful fail. We get them back alive. The last three, the last three Apollo missions were cancelled. They cancelled Apollo's 18, 19, and 20, and until then, they just found ways to minimize the amount of footage they would have to fake. Like on Apollo 12, Alan Bean, he points the camera directly at the sun, burns out the Videocon tube. No more videos. Apollo 14, Apollo 13, after the near disaster, they have to shut down all the video equipment, basically, so they have to reserve power and stuff, so No more videos there. On Apollo 14, the camera was overexposed, so the landscape is just a wash of bright light, and so the only real watchable footage is the flag salute video, which was shot, and the one video of Edgar Mitchell descending, which of course was just shot on film. They had like the 60mm film camera brought to the surface on the Apollo 14, and on the last three missions, which are the ones that had the rover, they would, rather than broadcasting the video as they traversed the surface, they had 60mm films, of course, but they would always stop the camera between missions, and so there was no videos essentially of the astronauts driving around all these miles and miles and stuff like that. And so, like I said, find ways to minimize the amount of footage they had to fake. And so after the Apollo program, they decided basically they wanted to focus on real missions again. And of course, that was the space shuttle. And the space shuttle was in many senses was a huge step back from the claimed success of the Apollo missions, because it didn't really go anywhere. It was just a flight into Earth orbit. And, you know, granted, it launched a few satellites that had contributed to the International Space Station, right? But essentially, it turned out to be a white elephant, because there was problems with the tiles, with the foam coming off the external tank. You know, they didn't even it was claimed to be reusable, but really it was more partially salvageable at best, because, you know, engine parts needed to be replaced and the like, and so it was really just a waste of money. And so, whereas the Russians, they've always relied on their Soyuz missions. They built their own version of the shuttle, which was in many ways superior to the American shuttle, because like it didn't have any main engines. It just hitched a ride on the Energia rocket, and had the ability to eject. It had ejection seats for all astronauts aboard. On the fifth shuttle mission, they took the ejection seats away to make room for the larger crews. And so,
you know, Jared, yeah, what this reminds me of is the business practice of the mafia.
Business practice of the mafia?
Yeah. Some kind of big scam goes on, they pour a hell of a lot of money into it, and then essentially it produces absolutely nothing, and then when the value drops and everything gets wasted, they collect the proceeds.
Essentially, yes, because the whole program, they decided they wanted to make themselves appear technologically superior, but once they got rid of the Apollo program and just focused on the shuttle, they essentially have found there's been many proposals to, quote, return men to the moon, but conveniently they've all been shuffled to the side or delayed or postponed indefinitely or this or that. Like it was George H.W. Bush, he proposed a return to the moon, and in fact they proposed using the Russian Energia rocket. The Russians, they've always had rockets that could potentially send an unsheltered, the key word is unsheltered spacecraft to the moon. There was the Zonda program, which I mentioned earlier, that they were sending unmanned Soyuz missions around the moon. Okay, the only thing they ever sent around the moon were extremophiles, like turtles and insects and bacteria. You know, extremophiles.
I thought that was an extreme pedophile, but go ahead.
No. Extremophile is a life form that thrives in environments that would have been hostile to humans.
Okay, sounds like a pedophile to me. But go ahead.
Well, the point is, in terms of turtles and stuff, they can take much higher doses of radiation than humans can. And in fact, it's believed that they can use turtle blood transfusions to actually cure radiation sickness in humans, right? Because these things, they can take something like 40,000 rads of radiation before they die. Whereas a human, it's much lower, something like 500 rads. And so, the point is that when they launched The Zond 5, they sent it around the moon unmanned, got it back to Earth. They sent the Zond 6. It crashed to Earth, but it was established that had the spacecraft been manned, they could have, you know, solved the problem to actually bring it back safely. Then Alexei Leonov, he was basically touting, let's man the next one. Let's man Zond 7. Let's fly around the moon, upstage the Americans before, because they had a window to launch the Zond 7 around the moon in December 7, 1968. The Apollo 8 was December 22, 23, something like that. Basically, the point is they had the opportunity. The Russians, they had the opportunity to launch 3 weeks at least before the Americans Apollo 8. Okay, they sent letters to the Politburo. They actually got suited up, went down to the pad in the event that their proposal was approved. It was rejected. Right? The N1, which was their equivalent to the Saturn V, they had four test launches that they failed. The fourth one, they believe, could have been saved had they shut down the first stage early and basically ignited the second stage sooner than they would have intended. They reckon they could have saved that mission. And on the fifth mission, they had planned on basically sending a completely unmanned dress rehearsal. They believe they had rectified all the engine problems on the N1. They would send an unmanned Soyuz and LK lander to the moon, basically do this completely unmanned. And if that was successful, the next mission would be manned. But the N1 was cancelled. There never was a fifth launch. And the guy who was in charge at the time, a fellow by the name of Mission, he was actually fired, and he was replaced by Valentin Glushko. Glushko, he invented the Energia rocket, which was used to launch the Soviet shuttle Buran, and that was they believed that they could use it to send 35 tons of payload to the moon. So potentially you could use that to send the N1 payload to the moon, you know, replace the N1 as the launch vehicle. Of course, Glushko had his own plans for a moon mission. He proposed one Energia to launch a five crew mothership, another Energia to launch the lander. They would dock in lunar orbit. Basically, astronauts would transfer to the lander, or cosmonauts, I should say, transfer to the lander and make the landing, but never used, never got off the drawing board. More recently, there's been proposals like the Deep Space Exploration Alpha mission, which was a private mission, right? And the Russian Space Agency backed down. So it's just up to the Space Adventures, this private organization, to pull it off. Although there's been debate about whether the rockets they're proposing would be even able to capable of lifting these unshielded spacecrafts. And so the whole fact of the matter is that they've had many opportunities to send a man to the moon in an unshielded spacecraft. They never took it because, back in 1963, Sir Bernard Lavelle, the Jodrell Bank Observatory astronomer, he went down to the Soviet Union, was given tours of the observatories, of the research facilities, of the spacecrafts they were building. They showed him everything, and they told him, the head of their Soviet Academy of Sciences, a fellow by the name of Keldysh, he told him basically that they were postponing manned moon missions indefinitely until they could solve the radiation shielding problems. You know, they said, we can't shield our cosmonauts, go tell NASA that, which Bernard Lavelle did. He wrote a letter to the deputy administrator of NASA, a fellow by the name of Dryden, okay, and they essentially ignored his warnings, right, and they just continued on with the Apollo program. Somehow, they make it to the moon, despite having no shielding.
Yep, it's just freaking unbelievable, isn't it? You, the mind reels. How obvious and how blatant the lies are. The media must be complicit in this, isn't it? Because every time anybody says something that they don't want you to believe, they go, oh, he's a conspiracy theorist. He must believe in the moon landing was fake. He must believe that Elvis is alive or something. For goodness sake.
Yeah, you tend to get a lot of poisoning the well in the media every now and then. Like, one occasion, for example, was that So they actually NBC was actually going to interview Bart Sobrel, do a special on the moon landing hoax. They pulled the story at the last minute because they were afraid that that their camera carried aboard the International Space Station would be monkeyed with if they badmouthed the Apollo program.
So there's a whole bunch of consequences that are basically being put up, and you know it comes back to the mafia, doesn't it?
It's just about the mafia and stuff.
I'm talking about the mafia business model rather than the specifically organized crime owning and running everything.
They seem to be essentially the mafia because they have a huge stranglehold on lunar geology, the radiation hazard. In fact, NASA actually released data from the Clementine and the Lunar Prospector missions, suggesting that the moon's geology was identical to that of the Apollo program's geology all out. And so for years, as a result of that, people were saying, oh, any claim that the moon was poorly sampled, that's a common misconception. We don't need to go back and get more materials and stuff like that. And then suddenly the Smart One crashes into the moon, sends up all this debris, and it's reported that the moon geology is different And never again was that spoken of. Never again. Only recently when the Chinese, they landed their unmanned their unmanned Chang'e 3 on the moon, they release the raw data, but they don't really tell us anything about it, so leaving us to essentially to do the calculations ourselves. I do the calculations and find that the soil is different from the Apollo soil. And the one of the reasons that people seem to think that the radiation in the Van Allen belt is inconsequential is because for years they had been relying on what's called the AX8. That's the AP8 and AE8 models for the Van Allen protons and electrons. Okay, now this model is based on averages from the 1960s. It was released in the 1970s. Okay, when about a year ago, I released a video called Moonfaker Radioactive Anomaly 3. And I did some calculations based on what kind of radiation astronauts should be absorbing from the high energy electrons. Everyone said, "Oh well, those electrons they don't exist in the outer belt because the AE8 and the AP8 models that indicates that all the electrons stop at 7 MeV and they just drop in flux towards that. The idea is that towards the 7 MeV the radiation fluxes go down, but." Really, the reason why the fluxes go down in these models is not because of a lack of electrons, it's because as the electrons get higher and higher in energy, they get harder to measure. Because you see, you need a very big detector to measure these high energy electrons. Okay, big means heavy, and that means expensive to launch, and so they tend to launch smaller, cheaper detectors up into space. And a rule of thumb is that as the electrons get higher in energy, they also penetrate much further. So for the really high ones, they'll penetrate right through the detector and deposit little energy. And as they pass through the metal on the spacecraft, the metal on the spacecraft gets excited and they release X-rays, which is then measured as noise in the detectors. Okay, so the reason the AX data stops AE8 stops at 7 MeV is not because of a lack of electrons; it's because of difficulty in trying to measure them. And in fact, it's been established that the AEX-8 data is very inadequate, you know, suffers from all these problems in trying to measure the high energy ones, and the AEX-9 is the more recent model, the one that they've released, which is considered an improvement over the original industry standard model, and even that has underestimated the doses that would have been received, as is evident by the recent Orion mission that flew into the Van Allen belt and detected much higher fluxes than what they were predicting under that kind of shielding, and of course much higher doses than what they claimed to have got underneath the Apollo spacecraft, which was about three times less than what was the shielding on the Orion.
Again, it just keeps coming back to the same scam over and over. It's a repeating pattern, isn't it? And yes. It just occurs to me that this exact same kind of scamology and pattern and scumbaggery sort of exists in almost every industry these days, doesn't it? Almost every institution.
It seems to be present throughout all the space stations, because all the other space organizations, you know, like ESA and JAXA. And they're basically the people have asked, well, why don't they blow the whistle on NASA? Well, they're essentially working together on various joint space programs. They're not going to be blowing the whistle on NASA. In fact, for quite a while, they were reliant on NASA's shuttle to lift their payloads into space. And the only non-collaborating space agency, which is the Chinese. What a surprise! They're their best trade. They're the best trade partners with the United States. They've got like a multi-billion dollar surplus right now, and basically their economy is booming. Whereas the Americans, it's in the toilet because of all these free trade deals. And of course, that essentially seems to be the price for the silence of the Chinese. And of course, that's not to say that I cited the Chinese unmanned mission to the moon as evidence that the data is different. But of course, that's not to say that the Chinese have a completely spotless record, because their first spacewalk, the Chinese spacewalk, was shown to have been filmed in a swimming pool. you know, basically to train astronauts for spacewalking. What they do is they actually put them in this underwater tank, that gives them a feel of natural buoyancy, okay? And so they can practice for spacewalking for a lot prolonged periods of time under this in this water tank, okay? And if you look at the video of the spacewalk, you can see bubbles drifting up out of the spacecraft every now and then. And in fact, a fellow at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, a fellow by the name of Dr. Q Zeng, he actually went on the record to say, "Yep, that was filmed in a swimming pool." Right, and I actually sent him an email just to confirm, because he was quoted in the papers and stuff. I just wanted to make sure they were quoting him accurately and stuff. And he said, "Yes, that's my opinion. That's my belief. It was filmed in a swimming pool." He also told me that the views of the Earth seen in the videos do not match up with what the views of the Earth should have looked like at that given point in time. And so, really, we just have it's like a situation where you don't tell on us, we won't tell on you. The only trustworthy space organization that seems to be is in the private sector now, because as I mentioned before, SpaceX, they're the ones who have been building this their Falcon 20 rockets. They got the Falcon 9 already, and they seem to be the only ones who legitimately seem to be interested in actually solving the radiation hazard, and are willing to acknowledge their mistakes. For example, Elon Musk, he was actually giving a talk at the Royal Astronomical Society, I think it was in England. Okay, he was giving a talk about what they plan to do in the future, and one of the things that was brought up was the radiation problems. He says, "Oh, that signs that there's problems stated, like you need several meters of water to shield yourself." And he said, "You don't need to have that. You just need to have a column of water and keep that column pointed to the sun." I sent him a message on his Twitter account, basically saying that that's not going to work because the solar flares are not directional. The sun has this magnetic field which deflects the radiation in all directions, and so the radiation is evenly felt from all sides. In fact, I showed him an example of a historical example of a solar flare. This is a recent one that actually was pointed away from the Earth, but the radiation was deflected towards the Earth by the sun's magnetic field. I sent him an email about this. I sent him a video I produced along these lines. He didn't acknowledge reception, but exactly 1 month later, he was quoted as saying that we need to solve the radiation hazard. He didn't acknowledge me or anything like that, but basically, a minute ago, he was saying, "Oh, it's not going to be a problem. We can just keep one side of the spacecraft sheltered, keep that pointed to the sun. That will be, you know, Bob's your uncle." But I said, "No, that's not going to work because of this and that." He releases another statement then saying that we have to solve the problem. So I can only hope that he realized his mistake and is rectifying it accordingly. That the evidence seems to point to that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what an honest scientist is supposed to do, isn't it? An honest person in general.
Yes, an honest person. If someone is making a mistake, the honest thing to do is to rectify that mistake, acknowledge it, and learn from it. Which is what Elon Musk seems to have done with his proposal to shield only one side of the spacecraft. And you know, that's the common misconception that flares are directional seems to have been just propagated endlessly throughout the propaganda sites. And in fact, one guy, Jim Olberg, he was actually paid something like $50,000 by NASA to write a book, basically trying to prove that we went to the moon. And he was in an interview in a TV show. He actually was quoted as saying, "Oh, the plan was to point the bulky end of the ship towards the incoming front of the radiation. That's not going to work."
It certainly won't. And unfortunately, we don't have any more time to discuss it in this segment. However, there is a break coming, ladies and gentlemen, so you're going to have a chance to get a WikiLeak and grab a coffee too, and tune in for the final hour of the broadcast today with Jarrah White at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Please support the broadcast by going to the website and signing up for a couple of dollars a month donation on a recurring basis to keep all the bills paid so we can keep exposing scumbaggery and not have to worry about where my next meal's coming from. We'll be right back. And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. And I want to ask you now, very kindly and very respectfully, to think back on how much you've been listening to this show. How many hours have you been entertained and or informed? What value does it have to you? Let's say you've watched 100 hours of videos. Let's say you've listened to 200 hours of radio. You can do that. It's quite easy. A lot of people have. And here's the thing. We don't charge you for it because we believe that it should be given out for free. There shouldn't be any barriers in the way of getting the truth for people. It should just be there, you know, right click, download, it's yours. But in order to do that, we have bills to pay and things of that nature. American Freedom Radio has their bills due for the end of this month. And I would encourage people to go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click on that donate banner. They only need a couple of $100. That's it. So if you come in, that's, 100 people donating $3. You know, 10 people donating 30. Pretty easy. Just chuck it on in there and support the network. Because the network supports all us radio show hosts that are on it. And it would be a great shame for them to live in real bad situations. The anxiety that unpaid bills can normally put on usually has a quality and reflection in the work. And for some reason, the more angry you get, the more messed up your machines start to play with, you know? You ever notice that? In fact, it's probably the other way around. I'm usually pretty calm, but when my machines malfunction, I'm not calm anymore. I'm really not. My very special guest is Jarrah White. And he is probably, like, when I first interviewed you, bro, I was like, I don't know whether or not we went to the moon, you know? And then after the interview was over, I was like, yeah, we definitely didn't go to the moon. And his website is moonfaker.com. That's moonfaker.com. And youtube.com/WhiteJarrah. So, Jarrah, welcome back.
Good to be back, and glad I could help you see the light.
Or rather, see the deception.
Yep.
Yeah. Knowledge of deception, I think, is probably one of those really essential things that you need to do in life, just in general. How do people deceive you? What kind of taxes do they use? What does scumbaggery look like, smell like, taste like, and sound like? You know?
Yeah, I got a whole fair share of that when I first started getting to, researching into the moon landing conspiracy theories, because for every moon hoax website or publication or whatever that I came across, there would be like 10 or so propaganda websites basically trying to say, no, we really went, but at the same time, they would basically resort to character assassination and lies. They would basically misrepresent the data. They would basically build straw man arguments, basically in the hopes that their readers do not have access to the source material of the conspiracy theorists. And, you know, it just went on and on. And, you know, finally, around the time when Bill Kaysing had passed on, I got so fed up that I felt it was finally time, because when he died, everyone was just jumping on his grave, you know, basically celebrating, hooray, you know, and this and that. And so they felt it was finally time for somebody to take a stand against these individuals. And so I started writing up a long, long essay, basically. It was supposed to be for download off the Bill Kaysing tribute site, which is, if you want to go to that, that's BillKaysing.com, right? But by the time I must have put in like a million hours in this thing, because I literally was refuting every single pro-NASA site, every single pro-NASA book I could find. And by the time I finished up this essay, it's about the size of a phone book. And of course, I needed to by this stage, of course, you know, because I was venting as I wrote this thing, I was venting out all my anger and frustration, because you know it's very hard to read these websites about, you know, basically putting up with all their shit, all the insults and character assassination. You know, I had enough.
I liken it to this kind of thing. It's like you're arguing with the juvenile Colobus monkey, you know? They just hop around and stamp around and go, you know, they're really just off the hinge, bro.
Yeah, I know. And so that's what I meant, is that it was very hard to write this essay without being, you know, infuriated. And so when I finally finished writing, and by this stage I had some time to cool down and develop some tolerance and stuff. And so I thought, well, perhaps it should be stripped here and there and stuff, or some of the less than pleasant things, I should say, about these individuals. And so by this stage, I had done my my film and TV course, and so I decided to adapt it into a video, and or rather a series of videos. And that's pretty much how the Moonfaker series came about. And as a result, I became number one on the hit list, you know, because I was constantly targeted. Well, in the beginning, they tried to avoid my productions like the plague, because I was refuting everything that they said. You know, basically treated as doesn't exist. Close my eyes doesn't exist, you know. But then when it became obvious that it wasn't going to be easy to ignore, they would try to find ways to try to undermine my credibility. Like in one example, where I mentioned the slow motion photography. Originally, it was thought that the videos were slowed down to 50% normal speed. It was later established that it was 67%. And everyone just jumped on that, like, oh, we can't do basic math. Ha, 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 ha. How's he expect to prove that the mission is fake? You can't do basic math. La, 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 la. And it just went on and on for about a year and stuff. But, you know, and when Ralph Renée died, they just trolled his death. And I became embroiled, really, in all their character assassination. It was guilt by association. But, you know, I finally, you know, I just, I honestly stopped worrying about what they say about me personally, because I consider them to be the human centipede. All these propagandists do is they feed shit to their followers, who in turn feed the same recycled shit to others. And that'd be the truth.
Yeah, it's like Chinese whispers, except ingested orally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite a disgusting phenomenon. In fact, that was the only movie I've ever seen, The Human Centipede, where I actually had to like pause the movie and just go to the bathroom just real quickly and just sort of like, okay, am I going to throw up? Am I going to throw up? And ultimately, that's indeed the correct reaction when observing.
Honestly, I never saw.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Consider yourself lucky. You don't want to see it. I've seen it, and I'm telling you, you don't want to see it.
I know. I never saw it. The Wikipedia article was more than enough for me, I guess. But the point is, it's a perfect metaphoric description of what these individuals do. Only unlike the centipede in Tom Six's movie, these guys actually thrive. They actually feed off the shit that they're being fed.
Yeah,
you know, they enjoy it. They love it, essentially, because you know liars they lie, and that's all they say is essentially shit. And honestly, I don't give a fuck what they say about me anymore, because you know life's too short, and you know what I say is perfectly true. I have the facts, the data to actually back up what I'm saying. All they have is character assassination and misrepresentation of the data. They don't even have the guts to represent what Van Allen said in his papers accurately. You know, he specifically talks about trying to avoid the Van Allen belts by using a trajectory that was completely unlike what they had. He proposed flying through what he called the cones of escape, which was where the Van Allen belts stop at the poles. You know, he specifically said that things are inclined to about 20 degrees north or south of the geomagnetic equator. Okay, and that can be correlated with some recent textbooks, which basically say you need a trajectory of about basically greater than 60 degrees to get to where the radiation flux is minimized. Okay, that's specifically said in his articles, in his Scientific American article from March 1959, his Space World article from December 1961. He specifically describes all this, and they just misrepresent. They try to twist his words into something that will support their case, because that's all they really have to work with, essentially. All they have to work with is quote mining, bad data, and underestimated models like the AE-8. And, they just don't have anything to go on.
Well, yeah.
They just have...
Well, they don't have any creativity is the thing. You know, it's like... Here's the thing that I've noticed. Although the lies are quantitative, they're not overly brilliant. You know, they're just nonsense that doesn't really have anything backing it up, and it's completely indefensible. It's not even a clever lie. And that's the what something David Icke said about psychopaths is that they got no creativity, right? You give them a blank piece of paper, they're fucked. But if you give them a piece of paper with a few ideas on it, they can twist it, they can distort it, and they can turn things around. But in terms of coming up with real, genuine human creativity and actual freaking smart, so they don't steal from anybody else. No.
I haven't seen much of David Icke's work, but yeah, that's a perfect description of what these guys have to do, essentially. One example that comes to mind when I was actually writing the essay was there's one guy by the name of Jay Windley. He often claims to be an aerospace engineer. I doubt he's worked in any of the things because he often demonstrated ignorance of aerospace history, aerospace practices. Anyways, one of the things he claimed was that Bill Kaysing, he left Rocketdyne before they started work on the Apollo program and therefore wouldn't have had any knowledge of it. And that's despite the fact that the engines that they were working on for the Apollo program, they began in the 50s, around either before or shortly after he actually joined Rocketdyne. And he left in 1963, which is a good 2 years after the Apollo program started. You know, they began with launches of the Saturn 1 back in 1961. And then Windley, when I pointed this out, Windley says, "Oh, he left before any significant breakthroughs of the F1." Well, no, that's not true either. There was the project first, which was, you know, assembled during his time. The project to try and rectify the F1 combustion instability problems. And the ultimate decision at the end of the day was that they didn't have the problem solved, which was that's been established. You know, he was aware at the time. He's seen these rockets explode and stuff. He had a good idea of the outcome of that. And so, you know, it just goes on and on. These propagandists, they just like to distort the facts. You know, blow things out of proportion, because that's really all they got to work on. Human centipede. That's the perfect description of them.
Well, have you ever noticed that if somebody's particularly bad and scumbagerical in nature, that there are so many accurate descriptions, one worse than the other, and it keeps getting consistently worse because I found that there's limits to things like goodness and morality and self-sacrifice. You know, there's only so much good you can do with your day or with your life, whereas there is almost no limits. In fact, none that I can see whatsoever on the behavior of scumbaggery sociopathic scum, right? They do things that you and I would never do because we've got a conscience, because we have this kind of thing that honesty matters, or basically we're human at our hearts and we're honest with ourselves. There's something different occupying these other motherfuckers.
Yeah, you wouldn't believe the kind of attacks I've had to endure. I've had my pictures of my face vandalized and photo manipulated, you know, cut and pasted onto vaginas. I've had my videos attacked by false copyright claims or whatever. And what else has there been? Oh, yeah, my privacy has been invaded on more occasions than I can care to remember. One guy dug up my personal doc and started sending me unsolicited mail. Another one started basically got a picture of my house that he copied from Google Maps and published it on his YouTube page. And I complained to YouTube. They did nothing about it initially. And another, let's see what else was there. Was other just actually published my address, my phone number, etc. on the internet. And, you know, it just goes on and on. These guys, they have no limits. They have there is no end to what kind of deceitful and dishonest and deceptive or downright immoral tactics that these guys will resort to.
Well, in fact, that tends to be the only thing in their tool chest. You know, you try to have a cordial conversation with them about something real or what. No, that's not going to happen, unfortunately. And I think that's the reason why the ridicule and everything has continued, because truth's kind of like a rock. You can cover it in dirt, but eventually the rain washes it away if you don't keep covering it in dirt. So it's a constant effort to keep the truth down. The truth doesn't have to do anything because it can speak for itself to a degree. In fact, strike that. The truth never speaks for itself, does it, Jarrah? It's always one person who finds it out who has to speak for it.
Essentially, yes, because you have to. When you got the data that proves that we've been lied to, you have to show it. You have to show it, and it tends to get There are three types of people. There are people who see the data and they accept it as what it's telling you, and you got others who violently oppose it or choose to ignore it or whatever, because essentially everything that they've been taught is a lie. Essentially everything they've been taught. Like I prepared the Chang'e 3 data. I presented it to two of my college professors. I'm doing astrophysics and geology as my degree. One of them, he was more skeptical of the Chinese than of NASA. The other, he didn't even glance at the data. Told me I fucked up, and just basically tried to poison the well and yeah, because that's just the way things are.
Well, here's another incidental thing. There's those people who aren't actually bad people, but they're simply brainwashed by scumbaggery pieces of shit, right? And these people are all playing a part in the scheme, but they don't realise that it is, because every time the information comes up to them, they instantly reject it because they have to. Their brain has literally built its entire justification for its whole existence online. So if you try to challenge the very foundation of their personality, the brain's designed to protect its own self and sense of self, so it will automatically treat you as hostile even if you're not.
That's a good example of what happened to me one time. Buzz Aldrin, he actually came down to Sydney once in it was in 2010, I believe. He was giving there was a piece of digitally remastered Apollo 11 footage that was to be screened at the Australian Geographic Awards ceremony, and I was actually invited to the press conference. That was the day before the actual ceremony, and I got a front row seat. I had a camera pointing at Aldrin, and a friend of mine basically had the handheld camera basically pointing back and forth between me and Aldrin. And when I got the chance to ask him the question, I asked him about the moon rock that had been given to the Dutch during their goodwill tour, which turned out to be a piece of petrified wood. I basically asked him, you know, not getting accusatory or anything like that, I just said to him, at the time when you were in possession of this, were you aware this was petrified wood, or were you also led to believe this was a genuine moon rock? He seemed very nervous in trying to, in hearing the actual question. And he went on to say, well, petrified wood. That doesn't sound like that came from the moon. It must have been switched, basically. The words he used was, what happens to that display after it's been presented to somebody is not our responsibility. If it got switched at some later stage, you know, yada, yada, that's outside our control. But basically, the exchange that was very civil, you know, very, no, you're a coward, you're a liar, a thief, like would be in the case we've bought Sabrella and things like that. It was very calm, very diplomatic, essentially. And after the press conference, some lady from the Sydney Morning Herald comes along, basically asks me where I'm from. You know, I give her my name. I'm Jared White. I'm from JW Studios. And next day, there's a huge article in the back of the Herald the next day with a headline, "Security, we have a problem." Basically trying to allege that I was some kind of antagonistic gate crusher that had to be removed from the conference, which was a complete lie. I've got the video footage of the entire conference showing that I was still there by the time the thing ended. You know, I've got the exchange. Oh, you're a coward, Aldrin. You're a liar and a thief, and none of the stuff that you expect from that Bart Sabrell punch incident. But the point is that
I was actually going to ask you, did you have the presence of mind to wear a mouth guard before you going in there, bro?
What do you mean?
Well, expecting to get punched in the face, wear a mouth guard.
No. Just a suit and a hat. That's all I came in there, my cameras.
You ever notice you're far less likely to be punched when you're wearing a suit? You know, that's what, like, somebody asked me that the other day. I went over to their house after a protest, and they said, "Well, are you wearing a suit, bro?" And I go, "Have you ever seen a protester wearing a suit getting beaten or arrested on TV? No."
See, that's, I don't know, why, that's why. Was wearing Bart Sabrell was wearing a suit, I believe, when he got punched in the face. So I guess that has.
I guess it's not infallible.
That was a very inevitable thing, because the heat was turned up on both sides. So he was. There was a Japanese production company that was interviewing both Sabrell and Aldrin and stuff. And so Aldrin was being interviewed. Sabrell was supposed to be the surprise guest. Aldrin, he left early, and Sprell ended up meeting him in the lobby, and basically Aldrin was calling him an attention seeker. He was like, "Oh, I know you'd like to get a lot of attention, wouldn't you?" And Sorrell was like, "Well, you're the one who just got paid $2,000 to talk for an hour or so about something that you didn't do, you know." And so then he was trying to get him to swear in the Bible, and of course things had already gotten antagonistic already because of the back and forth. So you're an attention seeker. Well, you're a liar and a coward and a thief, and he got punched in the face as a result of it.
It's like, what did you think was going to happen, bro? You know,
it could have gone better. That's all I can say. Could have gone better.
Here's how you do it. There's just one thing you don't do when you're trying to ask somebody real tough questions. Don't be an antagonistic dick, because it doesn't generally work out that well.
I suppose, you know, it's a bit of an issue though when the person you're trying to ask the questions to is already insulted you by basically calling you attention seeker, which is kind of ironic considering that he gives. Frequently, initially, Aldrin, he was a depressed alcoholic when he got back from the moon, allegedly, you know, crying in the gutter after an Air Force buddy asked him, "Hey, what was it like on the moon?" You know, and he would just get drunk and try to avoid answering the questions. And now he gives interviews willy-nilly, you know, constantly talking in the limelight about how he walked on the moon when he didn't. And, you know, this is my own opinion, but I think it's 100% accurate. I reckon the reason why is because, you know, it's tough to make... to make a living in the United States. You know, they don't have pensions, they don't have welfare or anything like that. So he decided, well, if I'm going to be doomed to live the rest of my life telling this lie, I might as well make something of it. And so that's probably the rationale that he came to after he got over his alcoholism.
How much money does he get paid to, like, come and speak at all these gigs? And how many is he doing them a year? Is he basically just cashing in on something he's only just recently got over the booze in order to cover basically his gambling debts or something or whatever? I'm just totally speculating and taking a stab in the dark here.
Well, I don't know what he charges per interview, but I know that the Japanese paid him $2,000 to talk for that special that he gave to the Japanese, in which they also interviewed Sobrell for. But as to how many interviews, they must have given, oh my God, I don't know, in the last year alone, he might have given about, I don't know, 10 or 12 or so. I saw him on the 7:30 report last year. He was on, there was a few documentaries he was in.
He was in a movie, wasn't it? Transformers 3, he was in there.
Yeah, he was in that too. Oh God, that film was just the shit. I did a whole review about that on my YouTube page. You can do a search on Jero Art Reviews Transformers 3. I mostly reviewed the moonwalk aspect of it because it's preposterous what they're proposing. He was proposing that Michael Bay, that they land on the far side of the moon to try and basically find the alien crash site and whatnot. It was garbage, because, like, for one thing, the Sea of Tranquility is on the near side of the moon, not the far side of the moon, and yet they can repeatedly refer to the far side of the moon and the Tranquility base as though they're the same thing. And another thing too, they loosely refer to the far side of the moon and the dark side of the moon as though they're the same thing. That's not true. The dark side of the moon is the portion that's, you know, the night side of the moon, the part that's not illuminated by the sun at the given time. The far side is the side that always faces the way. That's because the moon is tidally locked with the earth, so we only see one side of it as a result of it. But what really, really ticked me off in the film was they was implying that the Decepticon robots killed various people who were associated with the American and Soviet space programs, you know, basically try to keep them hush-hush about it, which is... I said this in the video. I said it was a ambiguous attempt to try and shift the blame away from those responsible for the deaths of Baron, his family, and the Apollo 1 astronauts. Because, you know, people who spoke up during the Apollo 1 fire, they got knocked off. You know, Baron, he wrote a 500-page report about the shoddy workmanship, the problems with the capsule, and all this mismanagement and stuff. He criticized NASA. He criticized the North American Aviation about it. The NAA and NASA, they both tried to discredit him. Another thing he reported was that the astronauts, actually the Apollo 1 crew, that's Grissom, Chaffee, and White, he actually interviewed a fellow by the name of Holmberg, who said that the astronauts had tried to get out, and for about 10 minutes or so, they reported smelling smoke or fire much earlier than was reported by NASA. They said that from the moment of first report of fire to the time that the capsule ruptured, they said only 30 seconds went by. Okay, here's one of the people on the team who reported it was much longer. Now Holmberg actually denied. He actually later denied what he told Barron. Although an RCA technician who actually watched the thing on the monitors, he was watching it with a group of people. His testimony correlates with what Holmberg said Holmberg told Barron, that the more time it went by, he said that 3 minutes went by from the moment of fire from the first moment of fire to the time the capsule windows filled with flames. Okay, so here we got two guys who reported the much earlier first mention of fire. Okay, one of them denied what he told Barron, and Barron, who made this report about it and a bunch of other things that went into the mismanagement and misconstruction of the Apollo 1 capsule, his car gets knocked off by a train. Okay, and of course Grissom, he was the one who was in the capsule. He was talking about how they're not going to be able to get to the moon. There was a 1 in 3 chance of the thing actually doing what it was supposed to achieve, and he actually hung a lemon on the spacecraft. And he was burned to death in the space capsule. And so basically, of course, there was various other Americans and American astronauts, and even on the Russian side, there was people who had died in training and stuff like that. And this, like, one of them that got covered up was a fellow by the name of what was his name? It was Valentin Bondarenko. He actually died in a oxygen fire similar to the Apollo 1 capsule, although his death was covered up by the Soviets. Okay, never revealed until after the Soviet Union collapsed. And of course, what Michael Bay was doing in the film, he was implying that all these cosmonauts and astronauts, they were all killed by the Decepticon robots. Let me tell you, if I ever run into that Michael Bay prick, I'm gonna punch him in the face. I feel tempted to punch him in the face because he was.
You'll have to get in line. There's actually quite a fan club of people that hate him, and he's on the number one of a number of worst directors of all time, top 10 lists. He's received death threats and things of this nature all over the place, bro.
Yeah, his movies are nothing but fast-paced editing that you can't even discern, explosions, and all he's ever done is taken history and nostalgia and shat all over it. That's all he's ever done. I'm going to punch him in the face and demand back the money that he stole from me.
Well, technically, he didn't steal it. He just scammed you into giving it. So technically, he frauded your money.
Essentially. First with Transformers 3, the second time with that god-awful Ninja Turtles film that he made. Let me tell you, when I went to see that film after it was over, I actually demanded my money back because it was just so awful. They didn't give it back to me. I went home later that night and got drunk because it was that terrible.
Yeah, you must have felt like a hero and a half shell.
Oh, God.
A hero and a half shell first.
More like a broken shell. More like a broken shell, really, because it was that awful and stuff.
It sounds like exactly
what I'll never watch another Michael Bay film for as long as I live.
Yeah. Of course, there'll be some kind of manipulation or whatever. I mean, that's why he's fit in so well in Hollywood. Hey, does this make no sense? Yes, it does. Can it be lazily done? Oh yeah, absolutely. Will there be lots of explosions? Sure. Will there be hot chicks that have no personality? Of course. Will there be fast cars that are really expensive that nobody could ever hope and fuck to get their hands on? Absolutely. All right. We'll let you make another film. Here's $400 million gone.
Oh God, that's every Michael Bay film in a nutshell, essentially.
That's why I love it so much, you know. you know, horses for courses. You can't account for taste, and ultimately, I like only the stylized aspects of it, because you may have noticed, but I have an incredible ability for the suspension of disbelief. You know, that's why I'm able to talk about so many different conspiracy topics, because there's nothing Hollywood could fucking dream up that was anywhere near as crazy as what really goes on.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. In fact, I actually not just in regard to conspiracy theories, but also in regard to science, I think, because at one stage I was actually making a series which you can look up on YouTube. It's called Sci-Fi in the Sky, in which I critique the errors in science fiction movies and explain why they couldn't possibly happen in real life. Like I believe I critiqued the Moonraker, that James Bond film where they hijacked the shuttle by launching it off the back of a Boeing 747, despite the fact that the shuttle gets all its fuel from the external tank. No external tank attached. How's it light the engines? And I also critiqued Godzilla versus Monster Zero, which had them visiting Planet X, which was depicted as being not too far from Jupiter, where it should have been destroyed by the Roche limit. You know, as you get too close to a planet with a much larger planet, I should say, if there's a Roche limit, it'll actually rip another celestial body apart if it's, you know, much less gravity, because that's the way that it goes. And I had planned for a third film in that, but it's just, fallen into production limbo, essentially. And unfortunately, a lot of my films have fallen into production limbo because I've just been way too busy with my astrophysics, my geology courses. You know, I've got like three or so assignments on the way at the moment. You know, I just don't get any rest anymore. It's crazy.
Well, here's some of the simple aspects of mind control that you might want to be aware of: sleep deprivation, repetition, and an authority that you can't really appeal against. Sound like a lot of your coursework there?
Well, it's honestly, I quite enjoy the coursework that I'm doing and stuff. But when I, surprisingly, I've only encountered two of my professors who have actually been at least accepting of my controversial views on the Apollo missions. One was my geology teacher, one of the two that I actually showed the X-ray spectral data from Chang'e 3 to. He was more skeptical of the Chinese, as I said, but he was willing to agree to disagree along those lines of Apollo. And more recently, one of my astrophysics teachers, he was accepting of my controversial views on the Apollo missions. And so all the others have been either violently opposed to it or just not willing to hear in general and stuff about it. You know, they have just propagated throughout their...
What would you say is a percentage of this? Because I know that people, when they get indoctrinated, there's a deprogramming process that happens afterwards and they can come back. Some people never do, though.
I don't know what the percentage of those types of people are, but...
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about in personal experience with your lecturers and whatnot.
Well, there's one occasion that actually... stands out in my mind, in which he was the lecturer. He got to the subject of the moon in one of his lectures, and he was actually said, "I found it very. I'm very disappointed in trying to find videos on YouTube to show for this lecture, because most of them go around saying that the moon landing was fake and he was bad mouthing it here and there and stuff." I was literally tempted to jump up and say, "You've got something to say about my films? You can just say it to me." But I kept quiet until he got to the subject about the rock samples. He was going on saying, "Oh, the rock samples are bone dry, and it's because of their being bone dry, we know that there was a giant impact. A Mars-sized planet collided with the Earth, caused all this material to clump together. That's why the moon rocks are the same as Earth rocks and why they're bone dry." And by that point, I had it. I jumped up and I said, "How do you explain that the rocks contain up to 6,000 parts per million of water, all the ferric iron, the fact that the rocks that the Russians collected have no ferric iron, no water, the only places where the remote detection missions have found water is up in the polar regions, all this sort of stuff?" He was stunned. He didn't have any explanation to give. And yet, for the rest of the interview, he was actually watching me closely in case I would like criticize anything else that he covered in his lecture.
"I don't like that person. He makes everybody realize that I'm full of shit." Was it that kind of look? Because I've gotten that look a few times, you know.
Yeah, he was very actually very trying to be cordial, really, trying to be diplomatic, I guess, but about to basically
I thought to be cordial was to get watered down.
Well, basically, he's trying to be what's the word I'm looking for? Basically trying to maintain the peace of the lecture at the moment, but he had his eye on me. Oh dear, here's the next slide, is he going to say anything? Here's the next slide, is he? Oh dear. Basically just keeping an eye on me, essentially, in case I have anything else to criticise.
Yeah, that kind of little paranoia bubble coming up.
I sent him a long... And I send him a long email at the end of the day, after basically with all the references and this and that, to basically explain why the giant impact theory is bullshit. Because as I said before, what they use to try and the scientists who look at the polar samples, they're desperately trying to come up with explanations for the copious amounts of water and ferric iron in the rocks, because the theory is, you see, because the rocks are chemically identical to terrestrial rocks and HDD meteorites and stuff, then they conclude, okay, the moon must have formed by a large Mars-sized planet with the same composition as the HED meteorites colliding with the Earth, and then debris from both worlds was basically blasted off into space and then clumped together to form our moon. And any water in that collision would have been vaporized. And so they say, oh, well, the rocks are rocks from Apollo. They're the same as the Earth rocks. They're the same as the HEDs, so therefore they must have formed from the same material, and they're bone dry, so therefore that's the giant impact theory. But the problem is that the rocks do contain water. They contain up to 6,000 parts per million of water. That's about 6% by weight water. Okay, and of course there's the ferric iron as a result of that as well. And so you can't get that in rocks that have been, you know, devoid of an atmosphere, devoid of water all these years.
And so unless of course you got rocks in your head.
they some of the excuses that they've tried to come up with is ridiculous. Like one group of people, I believe it was Greenwood et al. 2010. They were proposing that the water was delivered there by comets. They argued that the DH ratio, that's deuterium to hydrogen ratio, was more along the lines of comet water and basically greater than Earth water. But they underestimated the range for Earth water. Another group of people led by a fellow by the name of Hurry, they showed that the Earth water is the DH range for Earth water is more akin to that of the point is it overlaps the range that's been found in the Earth rocks and the Apollo rocks. So that doesn't hold water. It can't be comets anyways, because if it had crashed into the equatorial region of the moon, because the moon has no atmosphere and the temperatures are like 100 degrees in the daylight times. And remember, too, as you go up on a mountain where the air pressure is low, right, the air pressure lowers the boiling point of water. On the moon, it's something like minus 27 degrees Celsius. So if you basically had some water and in this vacuum, exposed it to minus 27 degrees Celsius, it'll start to boil. And, of course, we're not talking minus 27 degrees Celsius there. We're talking about 100 degrees Celsius. The only places where you'll be able to get water on the moon is in the polar regions, because there you get permanently shadowed craters, and even the daylight temperatures up there, they're much generally lower than the boiling point of water in a vacuum. So that's the only place on the moon where you'll find comparable amounts of water.
Do you reckon they've got, I don't know, I've heard all sorts of crazy stuff and I haven't really looked into it, but, you know, there's people who are saying that there's like a secret space program going on, and they've been going back to the moon and forth, and they've got like bases up there. You heard anything like that?
Oh, I've heard a lot of crazy things from stuff. In fact, actually, one of the things that I've actually been rather depressed to see when I've been posting videos is people who think that the Earth is flat, or people who have just lost all trust in NASA completely, that they don't just doubt the moon missions, they doubt all space travel. Like one time when I was I produced many videos about SpaceX, about how I believe we can solve the radiation hazard, to, you know, basically use their technology to get us past the radiation belt onto the moon, onto Mars for real. When I started producing videos about that, people who doubt space travel in general, they all came crashing at me like a ton of bricks, basically saying, oh, he's a NASA stooge, he's this, he's that, he believes that, he's a disinformation agent, yada, yada, yada. Basically, no, these...
For fuck's sake.
I know. I mean, how people, if anyone who thinks I must be a NASA stooge, they must have rocks in their head or something, because I'm the biggest sharpshooter on NASA's moon landing hoax claim. But if NASA has done something for real, I'll acknowledge it. You know, an honest person is, give credit where credit is due. Neil Armstrong, he didn't walk on the moon, but I will give him credit for being the first man to dock a spacecraft. He nearly came close to death when he docked his Gemini spacecraft with the Agena rocket, and the thruster on their spacecraft was jammed and went them spinning out of control. That was the first docking in space. That paved the way for the ISS, for the Mir station, all these missions that required docking, you know, in orbit. You know, that was a real space, that was a real space mission there, the Gemini 8, okay? Apollo 11, not so much. So I can't give him credit for being the first man on the moon, because he wasn't. Credit for the first man to dock in space, I'll give him kudos for that, okay?
Do you reckon there is the first man on the moon?
Wasn't the first man, no one was the first man on the moon, because there's never been a moon landing, a manned moon landing. But the problem is that because NASA has become so untrustworthy with the moon landing, is that people have started to doubt everything that's in space. I posted a video basically sharing the pictures of Pluto by the New Horizons mission, and people started coming in saying those photos were faked. Well, I don't have any reason to suggest that the New Horizons mission was faked. And you know, I one of the things that I said to them was that I don't trust NASA. What I trust is my interpretation of the data. You know, if the data passes scrutiny, the rational thing is to accept it. If it doesn't, you reject it. If the data doesn't support what the person is claiming, right? Then the logical step is to dismiss what that person is claiming. Dismiss it as false. Okay. If it passes scrutiny, then the idea is to accept it. Like, for example, how do we know that there is a International Space Station orbiting our heads? Well, one thing, first of all, we can actually see it. If you're lucky, you can actually see the ISS moving across the sky as a little star moving across the sky. Okay, and if you have a few hundred bucks of a telescope equipment, you can actually resolve the ISS as it passes by. And furthermore, right, I've seen videos of the astronauts, you know, floating aboard the ISS for far longer than would be possible within the KC-135. Others have pointed to the plane. It goes through these parabolic arcs and eliminates gravity in 30 seconds, right? If you were to time the videos of the International Space Station, you find they're much floating around for much longer. And also, some people say, "Oh, well, how did you know they didn't do it like they did in that movie Gravity with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney?" Well, the zero gravity scenes were actually, believe it or not, the zero gravity scenes inside the space mission, inside the space station, were actually filmed by filming Sandra Bullock swimming around underwater in front of a green screen, because apparently she was very able to hold her breath for quite a long time. And so they were able to film her underwater for about like 3 or 5 minutes or so, give or take. And so that's how we were able to get those long videos of them, of her floating around in the International Space Station.
That's right? Really, but awesome.
The International Space Station, they're floating around for much longer than that, and they obviously don't have a breathing apparatus, right? So therefore, the International Space Station is for real. Okay, why would anyone want to doubt that? But for whatever reason, we've got people who think that the Earth is flat or that all space travel is faked, and they just went into go into the comments posting their crap about this. And even on Facebook, I had this one guy who was constantly sending me videos and links for people who think the Earth is flat or think that all space travel is fake. I tried to explain as best I could, basically explain to him why what he's proposing is wrong. You know, like one guy said was, "Oh, we can observe gravity by dropping something. Well, we can observe that, but how can we prove that the Earth is round without NASA?" Well, for starters, we know that the Earth is round because the gravity doesn't pull things down, it pulls them towards the center of mass. And you know, if the mass is large enough, it'll be rounded by its own gravity. That's basic science there. You know, that's physics 101. Okay? High school physics even. Anyone who's done high school physics should be able to understand that. And yet we've got people who believe the Earth is flat who doesn't understand gravity. And I tried to explain to him that why we can believe the International Space Station videos. He just ignored it, would point to another video. And finally, I got annoyed and I had enough, and I said to him, "Listen, it's over. I've had enough, okay? There is overwhelming evidence that the Earth is round. There is overwhelming evidence that man has been in space. And yet, like some diehard creationist, you blissfully dismiss it. You've wasted more than enough of my time. Don't bother talking to me again until you grow a brain and develop some rational thought."
It happens exactly like that, doesn't it? And here's the thing. It's about testing. This is the thing. I was having a conversation with a mate the other night, actually, bro. You know, knowledge has no value. Here's why. If it's not put into practice, it has no value. Right? Mm. So if somebody tells you a little factoid or something like that, but you don't actually go and test it and put it into practice, you don't actually know that fact.
Mm. Yeah. That's another example too, is that if you, one of the things that people would claim about all space travel being faked is they would claim, oh, well, rockets don't work in space. Huh? There are two types of people who seem to think that. One is the type of people who don't seem to understand the difference between jet engines and rocket engines. A jet engine works by sucking all the atmospheric air into the combustion chamber where it's ignited with the fuel. Basically, it launches all the gas out the back and basically propels it. A rocket doesn't need the atmospheric air because it brings its own oxidizer aboard in separate tanks. You know, you've got a fuel tank and an oxygen tank. Okay, they get stored in separate tanks. They're pumped into the combustion chamber and it ignites. And it doesn't need air from the atmosphere to work. And the others who don't seem to think that you heard a whistle there. That was a Gmail message coming in.
I thought it was a chick having you on.
Maybe, but anyways, as for the other group of people, they don't seem to understand the action reaction thing. An example that people will like to use is a balloon. Okay, the balloon inflates. It inflates. What happens when it inflates? It actually got higher air pressure than it has on the outside, and that's why it inflates. If you let go of the balloon, all that high pressure shoots out the back. One guy said, "Oh, well, that's not going to work in space because there's nothing for it to push against." I said, "Yes, there is. It's pushing against the actual balloon itself." In fact, so for the same principle, right? A rocket works by firing all this high pressure gas, which is much higher than atmospheric pressure. As a result, it's pushing against the rocket and it wants to push somewhere. In fact, rockets would work better in a vacuum than it would in space because, think about it, the external pressure outside the rocket is zero. It's zero PSI. Inside the rocket's like a few thousands of PSI, right? A few hundreds of thousands of PSI. And so, obviously, the pressure, when it gets released into the vacuum is basically no pressure. So, obviously, it's going to be pushing up against the rocket, pushing in the opposite direction. So, it's going to work better in a vacuum than it would in an atmosphere. So who the fuck are these guys think they're kidding? These people don't understand the science, and yet they just go blabbing off their big mouth saying the Earth is flat or that rockets don't work in space and that all space travel therefore is fake, yada, yada, yada. It's just nonsense.
Yeah.
I just don't bother with them because I give my attention to serious researchers, not deniers and not people who only want the attention.
I was talking with my niece last weekend, and she says, I'm really smart. And then I asked her a very simple, basic math question. She got it wrong. And I said, some of the smartest people don't talk about how smart they are, love. and that's the thing. So. Idiots tend to just shoot their mouths off without thinking. And, you know, it's not the wisest move, ultimately, at the end of the day. And you wind up almost proving, if not illustrating, your stupidity.
Mm. Yeah, that's another thing that comes up in a lot too. A lot of people like to say, "Oh, well, you must think you're smarter than every scientist in the world because most of the scientists there think that the moon landings were real." Well, I don't claim to be smarter than the scientists. I don't claim to be smarter than, you know what? I openly call myself, until I get my degree, I openly call myself an astrophysicist in training. Or a geologist in training, depending on because I'm doing two majors, you see, right? one in astrophysics, one in geology. So until I get my degree, I call myself astrophysicist/geologist in training. Okay, I don't claim to be smarter than the rest, but if the data that they're using, right, conflicts with their belief, the rational thing to do is revise your belief accordingly. Okay, we've got data from the Orion, which shows much higher dose rates than what was claimed on the Apollo craft, despite the fact that the Orion has much thicker shielding than the Apollo spacecraft. We've got 24 frames per second in the video footage, despite NASA claiming that it was 10 frames per second originally. Okay, and the data from the Chang'e 3, it shows the composition is different. We've got ferric iron oxide in the rock samples, which you can't get unless you expose it to the air for a long time. Okay, so if all your data, right, conflicts with your belief, you should revise your belief. You don't go trying to talk your way around it, trying to find reasons or excuses to try to justify all these anomalies in question. You if it conflicts with your belief, you change your belief. That's the smart thing to do.
I catch myself doing that on occasion, and I go, "I'm really angry at this person. I disagree with them. I'm not going to listen to this." And then I go, "Whoa, wait. You're being an idiot." Oh, okay. Shit, I'm being an idiot. Okay, I have to sit down and force myself against my instinct to read the data that conflicts with my belief, right? You have to force yourself. And I found that that's the difference between good people and evil people, is the level of restraint and the level of control over your own actions, what you're willing to force yourself to do, that kind of thing. Good people do that, yeah. Whereas bad people, they act completely without restraint at any time.
Yeah, the propagandists in particular, they have no restraint. They just, like Van Allen specifically wrote in his in his early articles that he didn't believe that they could shield the astronauts he proposed they would have to fly through the radiation free zone over the poles. That's explicitly stated throughout his papers. He was talking about docents.
People don't know that, okay? They think Van Allen is some kind of rock band.
Yeah, well, the point is that they later on, after the Apollo missions, he recanted and basically went on to say, oh, it must have been a sloppy statement. And the propagandists, they're fond of citing his subsequent retraction. Never do they mention his original statements, or if they do, they try to twist it into turn it into something to support their argument. And so, you know, like I said before, they're the human centipede. All they do is they just feed shit, eat it, and just feed it to other people again.
Actually, they're the ego centipede.
Yeah, that's pretty much accurate, isn't it? That's a good term for it.
Hey, and
actually, I call them the propaganda peed. That's what I call them.
The propaganda peed. Yeah, like how they portray the European Union and Herman von Rompuy, and I could keep going on, but I'm not going to. You can tell that I'm at a very low point in my life and my career. I also wanted to get on from this because dealing with trolls and things of that nature, like somebody asked me the other day, Jarrah, and I'm sure you've been asked this question as well, considering you do what you do and say what you say in such a public forum and in such a way, has anybody tried to suppress you or to attack you or take you down or something like that? And my first instinct was to say, no, nothing at all has ever happened to me. And then it was only a couple of days later that I realized, actually, there's been constant trolling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's been revealed through government documents that have been declassified that they're setting up these things, okay? Groups of trolls being paid 50 cents a comment to disrupt and distract and to derail conversations and arguments and lines of thinking. And the defamation and the deception and the scumbaggery could not be more explicitly explained. Like, they actually have an entire list of how to disrupt, of how to defame, you know? And it seems to me that what happens in our society that is controlled by people who have far more power than they've earned. Power should only be given to you if you've actually earned it, otherwise you don't know the value in it. You don't know the value of strength. So they've got this unearned power that they use to suppress anything that threatens that power. Isn't it interesting? It's like a negative feedback loop, like a snake eating its own tail. Jarrah White has been my very special guest, ladies and gentlemen. His website is moonfaker.com and his YouTube channel, youtube.com/WhiteJarrah. You can check out the archives at AmericanFreedomRadio.com and the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Now, Jarrah, you got any quick final words? We've only got a few seconds left.
Yeah, well, I've been suppressed a few times. Mark Gray, for example, filed false DMCAs when I showed that the Apollo 10 telecasts were all pre-filmed and edited together. You can look all that up in Flagging the Gems.
All right. Jarrah White, ladies and gentlemen, and get this video and this radio broadcast out to other people, because it's been really interesting, wasn't it? Really interesting. Thank you, bro, for coming on. I know how busy you are. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Please donate at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. We'll be right back.